You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Brad Loncar, Josh Schimmer, Sam Fazeli, and Don Bell. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So most of us were in San Francisco this week for the 42nd annual JP Morgan Healthcare Conference. Well, in some ways, it's just another investor conference. All of the peripheral activity, the strong senior level pharma participation, along with the big news focus, has made it into a sort of barometer for sentiment in the coming year. And I'd say for the first time in the past 3 years, it felt really positive to me. There was a bunch of deals that closed at year end, which we discussed last time. Following such a strong M&A year, we expect to see cash recycled and biotech stocks benefiting. And then this week also kicked off with some nice deals, which we'll go through later. Eric Tocat at CenterView, who's been involved in almost all of the $1 billion plus deals last year, said that pharma is actively shopping. He thinks 2024 is going to be a very strong year for M&A. And the areas he cited as being hot are cardiometabolic, CNS, radiopharmaceuticals, and I&I. So Brad and Josh, it was great to see you at the Hangout party, and Brad, to be a guest on your amazing biotech TV show. I saw your interviews this week, and they looked like they were so interesting. Can you summarize what stood out for you, and then we'll go to Josh?
Thanks. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I did 20 videos, which is about my limit before I collapse, because, you know, I'm like uploading them and everything is actually like most of the work. A few themes that I would point out. We talked a lot about autoimmune diseases. You know, we've been talking about this on Hangout a lot, like over the last year, is that like oncology will always be a focus. But there seems to be a shift towards autoimmune diseases and I&I. And like, I interviewed the CEO of Argenx. And, you know, that's arguably one of the, if not the biggest biotech success story from a market cap perspective over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, it's a $25 billion company. I think it was over $30 billion at one point. And right now it's one drug. And basically they're focused on IgG, you know, driven autoimmune diseases. And he said that he believes, like from the literature, that there's literally 100 diseases caused by overactive IgG. And so that partly explains why it's like a $25 billion company. And interestingly, and so when you have something that's heating up like that, you know, that draws a lot of eyes. So, you know, earlier this year, Immunovant had a success with a similar drug. They target the neonatal Fc receptor. And I had a really interesting interview with the CEO of Biohaven. And rather than targeting the neonatal Fc receptor, they're doing degradation and actually trying to do degradation against IgG directly. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if they succeed with that. They have primate data that looks pretty good, but they're going to have some human data in the first quarter that's interesting. And I think degradation is just a theme in general. Like, I also interviewed John Euler, the CEO of BeiGene, and, you know, their big drug is Brukinsa, the BTK inhibitor that they've been developing and that has shown superiority against Imbruvica. And they, like a lot of other companies, are starting to develop degraders. And so we'll have to see if degraders, for something like BTK, can be as successful or more successful than small molecules. So those are a couple big themes. And then of course, this is, I think, both real and controversial, AI. If you listen to the JP Morgan webcasts from companies, I'll bet you like 70 or 80% of them probably highlighted how they're using AI to, you know, quote unquote, totally revolutionize drug development. And, without a doubt, it's real. I mean, there's drugs that are succeeding today in part through help from like machine learning and AI. But I think one challenge of our industry, especially for investors, like everything sounds awesome, you know, in the room. Like everybody says they've got the best mousetrap. But I think one thing that investors are going to have to start to get good at is doing due diligence to figure out who's got, like, you know, reels, you know, like, you know, really top-notch platforms, and who's just, you know, kind of all talk. So I think that's a theme too. And then, you know, of course, with all the deals, I mean, you already mentioned it, Daphne, that's really what got everyone excited. You know, we were all hoping for some deals coming into this event, and we got some. And so that really makes, you know, makes us all feel good. And the outlier here is Cytokinetics. You know, there was like a couple stories that suggested that maybe Novartis was looking at them and then maybe not. And that, you know, that's one that's like still to be determined. And I have some thoughts on that that I can share later. But yeah, all around, like, I would say those were kind of the big themes that that came out of my videos.
Yeah, we'll talk about Cytokinetics in a moment. I wanted to keep it a little bit more high level first. So let's talk some more about the state of the industry, Josh. And then I think Sam wanted to comment on what large pharma is doing generally on M&A. And then we'll go into the week's deals, starting with Don discussing Novartis and particularly Cytokinetics, but all the deal spree that was going on this week with Novartis. So let's start with Josh on, you know, just broadly, how was the week for you, state of the industry? You know, any different thoughts this week?
Yeah, thanks, Daphne. There's always a little sizzle going into JP Morgan and then a little fizzle coming out of it. So I'm not sure this year will be any different. We kind of got a regular so far January in terms of M&A. My JP Morgan experience, you know, quite good. I was glad that the rain wasn't too bad as we were walking from hotel to hotel. So that was a highlight. But more importantly, as a highlight, there are a lot of good companies out there, as we've talked about in the past. You know, given how strong the sector's been over the past few months, you know, we're starting to see areas of a little bit of frothiness, some signals of a bit of an overbought condition, and so that might add to a little bit of temporary fizzle in the coming weeks. But, you know, still very strong innovation occurring. Personally, I think, you know, the best places to look for opportunity tend to be in the smaller cap space, and, you know, I still do believe that sub 500 million, sub 300 million, you know, you can really find some very interesting opportunities there. Companies that have delivered fairly clear proof of concept in early clinical trials, and, you know, for some reason they just haven't really hit investor radar screens yet. So, you know, I had about 40 meetings over the 3 or 4 days, and I thought half of them were just really strong, solid opportunities for me and other investors to consider. So a little bit more cautiously bullish, a little bit more selectively bullish on this space than I've been in the past, and also cognizant that, you know, when the sector does roll, you know, it can often affect even the most compelling names. So, you know, that's biotech, and you just kind of have to roll with the punches and try to stay as long-term focused and opportunity focused as possible.
Thanks, Sam.
Yeah, so I think I just want to distill what I think I heard from the large pharmas, and the majority were still talking about bolt-ons, or at least carrying on the same that they were doing. And I think specifically, I know Brad wants to talk about this a bit more. Novartis CEO Vaz pretty much repeated that comment, and then it ended up creating that situation for Cytokinetics. But of course, we had the same thing before. Generally, the pharma companies talk about bolt-ons and not necessarily going after elephant hunting. And then, of course, you see deals like that during the year. So I don't particularly, I mean, this is not about saying truths or untruths, I think it's part of expectation management or price management, value management. I don't know what you want to call it. Well, the other element that was quite interesting was the comments that came from Albert Bourla, Pfizer CEO, who was in a very apologetic frame of mind, I think, as if you listen to his presentation. But he coined a couple of phrases, Pfizerizing Seagen and Seagenizing Pfizer, which I chuckled at. Now, the first company that did buy a biotech and kept it at arm's length was, of course, Roche with Genentech. And I think what Pfizer is talking about is we don't want to integrate this anymore. If anything, what they've done is that they've cut $2 billion or $2.5 billion off their own R&D and then putting the Seagen R&D into their books. And similar comments from Lilly's CEO. And of course, you've seen that in action with Loxo. So that I'm assuming and I hope will become a trend because it really does help keeping these biotechs with the culture that they have at arm's length and allowing them to do what they do and you managing your business alongside it. So those are really the couple of things that I took away from it.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear because I think that pharma companies want to get access to biotechs because they're innovative, but sometimes that can really suck the innovation out when you get integrated into one of these larger companies and all of the bureaucracy. So it's good to hear that they're thinking of it that way. Don, what did you think about Novartis's deal spree and also the whole Cytokinetics thing?
Yeah, so so on the Cytokinetics deal and the on again, off again nature of it, I have to say that is the first time in my memory of, I was at Novartis for 10 years and that I ever saw like a deal leaked to the press. So I found that very surprising. Cytokinetics has the aficamten, which is a best in class cardiac myosin inhibitor that's set to compete with mavacamten, which BMS, you might remember, acquired via its $13 billion acquisition of MyoKardia. And I remember the MyoKardia acquisition at the time, I was in BD at Novartis and we were all kind of scratching our heads at that valuation. So I'm wondering if, as maybe bidding heated up and, things heated up and the price maybe, went beyond what their models had suggested was, what they were willing to pay. I'm just speculating. Of course, I have no inside knowledge. It's important to note that, peak sales of mavacamten, although estimated around $4 billion, have been very slow to get off the ground. So BMS's CEO, in their third quarter call, made a comment on this, calling out the slow uptake in the mavacamten launch. So I'm sure if I, were sitting in that seat at Novartis and I see that, with bidders coming in and that price kind of starting to approach that $3 billion price, $13 billion price, who knows what happened. I might have been cautious, or maybe there was no basis in the rumor in the first place. Well, I guess we won't ever know until long after this is settled.
Don, I have a follow-up for you on the leaking, and I actually would love to get Sam's thoughts on this. I always wonder who benefits from leaking, and I know that Bloomberg often benefits from people leaking to them, but like who, if you're an advisor to a company, either bank or legal or whatever, what do you get out of it? And, it can cause a lot of damage, especially if it doesn't end up working out.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely had a short-term jump, right, in Cytokinetics stock. Day traders may have benefited, but they probably would have been in a position to leak. So that's a great question. I don't know if Sam...
Right, because if you're in a position to leak, you're an insider, right? So is it just a relationship-building thing with Bloomberg, or what do they get out of it? And it seems like such a big risk.
I'll jump in on that. I think a lot of times it's to put pressure on the target to sell. Mm-hmm. Like for example, look at the timeline, and I'm just speculating. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I have no knowledge, but like, look at the Merck Harpoon one. So like, that also, I think it was Wall Street Journal that broke that like 12 hours before it was announced, and they had the price and everything. Like they had all the details. Like clearly, somebody gave them like all the specifics. And I've always believed that the idea there is if the acquisition target like board is trying to be aggressive about like holding out for a higher price or maybe thinking of not doing it or whatever. If you're Harpoon and if you're like a $3 stock and you double based off of the story being leaked, well, if you you know, end up turning the deal down, then your stock crashes right back down to earth. And so I've always believed it was a tactic by somebody on the larger company's team or the bankers or whoever to like pressure the other company's boards to accept the deal.
Yeah. I mean, you called me. I can't speak for Bloomberg. I'm not in the news team. I'm in the research group. And honestly, I don't know how these things function. The only thing I can say is any news reporter is always looking for a scoop, always looking for something that they can break, whatever firm or company they're in. And I think actually it was Wall Street Journal or Deal Reporter, I can't remember which source that came up with Cytokinetics. I think Harpoon was Bloomberg. But I've never actually, in the 13 years I've been there, I've never actually gone over to ask my news folks how this works, why does it work, how did, but honestly, and especially if it's on quotable sources, whatever the right phrase is, I wouldn't know anyway. So we have a pretty big, thick wall between us and news, and I don't know. I don't know the answer. And I think Brad's speculations are probably as good as any.
Yeah, but you think about it. If it is a large bank that's trying to put pressure on, you know, the smaller company, either the large bank or the large company, it's like, I mean, reputationally, I just think it would be so fascinating if somebody would look into it. But that's really borderline. Anyway, Don, you wanted to say something. And also, yeah, maybe you could talk about some of the other Novartis deals that happened this week. So we had Calypso. I think Sam was going to cover that. And the RNA drugs from Chinese biotech. And then Alphabet's Isomorphic. But just in general, since Don, you know a lot about Novartis, what have you been hearing about them on a deal-making side?
So I would comment on the RNAi drugs. The targets were not publicly made available, but they did say they would be to strengthen their cardiovascular metabolic pipeline. And Novartis has a long history as one of the leaders in cardiometabolic disease. And I would speculate that perhaps, you know, there may be other lipid targets in that bucket that could fit maybe in PTL3, maybe, just guessing. You know, that would certainly fit nicely with their portfolio, with inclisiran for LDL lowering and pelacarsen for lipoprotein little A, and, you know, expand their RNA. They're probably with inclisiran when it gets to peak sales will be the largest manufacturer of an RNAi drug in the world. So to leverage that platform, I think that's a really nice play. And I think, as we talk more about Aleos, if I'm saying that right, and other deals, you know, this Chinese in licensing this Chinese innovation into, I'll call it more Western companies, doing air quotes here. That's a really interesting trend too. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that as well. And Sam, you wanted to comment on the maybe on the Calypso deal. I don't know much about that one.
Actually, on the Argo deal, I thought as I was running around trying to see what are these targets. Actually, if I'm not mistaken, in the presentation by Vaz in his commentary, I think he said that one's PCSK9 and one's Ang2, angiotensin 2. And these are annual dosing, and he referred to them as their defense for instance, Leqvio in an IRA setting. Now, I might be putting too many bits of commentary together to make up this thing. So, if that is the case, I'll accept it. But I think that's what I saw.
I see.
And it's interesting with Argo because it was formed only a couple of years ago, and raised about $103 million so far, and there we go with $185 million upfront. It's pretty good in that sort of time frame. Although it's, I think your commentary on the Glaxo deal is going to trump this very easily. So, Daphne, did you want me to carry on with the two or three other things and then go back to Dawn?
Yes, I think that would be
okay. Yeah, so Harpoon was one that we haven't talked about. $680 million by Merck. It's a TriTac, so three, it's Harpoon, hence the name, right? CD3, DLL3, and there's a little binding motif for albumin in there. And the idea is that it's useful in neuroendocrine tumors and small cell lung cancer, which of course is where a lot of high hopes were generated by Amgen's data with their BiTE. Now, we've seen some data, and of course, that's what got the share price motoring into ESMO and after ESMO, and then probably led to this deal. So it depending on how you look at the data and what denominator you use is between 26% to 32% response rate, which does look a little shy of what Amgen reported from a much larger patient set, 100 patients. But it looks like that the side effect profile is slightly more amenable. So this looks like the drug that drove the Merck deal. And so we're into the world of T-cell engagers. And Calypso, and I think my information gets lower and lower and lower as we go down this list. Calypso, private company, IL-15. It's been around for a while. I think it was founded in 2013. And raised clearly money along the way. Anti-IL-15, not a lot of people in the anti-IL-15 world, according to my little search on the Bloomberg. Amgen, again, comes up with AMG-714, which is an anti-IL-15. Celiac disease is the target. And they're moving forward quite meaningfully with that because they've seen some proof of concept data in a gluten challenge study. And I think this is what's driven this, and it fits into Novartis's inflammation I&I overall picture. So, and what the antibody does, IL-15 seems to be involved in inducing the accumulation of inflammatory lymphocytes into the intestine, and therefore you're blocking that. And it is a little bit behind of Amgen, but I think I'm assuming that Novartis saw some meaningful data there. What's interesting is that there was no press release from them, neither on this nor on Argo. These are, both of the news came out of the companies themselves. So, and lastly, on and getting even less information here, Isomorphic. I think now Brad might know quite a lot more about this, given that he's I don't know. I'm not putting him on the spot here, but. Yeah, this is the Google bio business, so where AlphaFold lives, and they have clearly gone much further than it, new iterations of AlphaFold, which can do a lot more. If you look at their website, which everybody can read, they talk about small molecule design and nucleic acids and DNA and more refined protein folding. On their website, it's interesting because we don't know what these deals are for. So Lilly, $45 million, Novartis, $37 million. There's sorts of money, maybe Dawn can comment, that I think are, okay, but let me have a look and see what I can do with this technology as opposed to I'm committing a major amount of effort here.
Yeah, but it's interesting because the press release or some of the news, they talk about $3 billion, but you know that's pretty much biobucks. So
yeah, no, I mean, the Argo was $4 billion too. I usually tend to ignore those because having lived in biotech for so many years, majority of that number very rarely crystallizes. But on their website, it's interesting, they refer to one of the molecules and they do a back test. And one of the ones they refer to is a company that I know relatively well, and that's Revolution Medicines' pan-RAS and KRAS inhibitors, which are not the usual mechanism. They bring in cyclophilin and the drugs work as a kind of a molecular glue. And they then showed in their little images that if they were using their software, they could pretty much predict the molecule that was developed by at least Revolution Medicine, which I know well enough. So that's interesting. And if they're that accurate and that good, then I think there's going to be lots of noise coming out of this.
Yeah, I was actually surprised, Daphne, to see Novartis do a deal on small molecule drug development because there's a lot of pride and expertise, you know, really deep expertise. I can't remember how many chemists, you know, 200-300 chemists. But they must see some capability there that they want to kick the tires on that would take a long time to build themselves that Isomorphic's already built.
Yeah. And I want to go to the biggest deal of the week, which is J&J buying Ambrex for $2 billion. But before we do that, let's just pick up the thread on GSK announcing that it's acquiring Aiolos, and I also don't know how to pronounce that, Aiolos Bio, for $1 billion up front, plus $400 million in contingent payments. This was sort of crazy because Aiolos in-licensed this program in August, raised $240-ish million from Atlas and a bunch of other great firms, and then basically flipped it What do you think about this one, Dawn?
Sam and I were corresponding, you know, in a prep for the meeting. I'm like, did they get lucky, or what happened here? And, you know, Sam's point was, why didn't GSK just buy this asset themselves for $25 million 6 months ago? So just a little bit of background. So this is so Aelios had acquired this anti-TSLP antibody from the Chinese innovator Hengrui, if I hope I'm saying that right, this past summer, as I said, for about $25 million, a little under that. TSLP is an IL-7 like cytokine that's associated with allergic and eosinophilic inflammation. And AZ and Amgen has a molecule, Tezspire, that's approved in asthma. It was approved in late 2021. That's administered Q-monthly. Hengrui's molecule, or Aelios's molecule, is actually looking at twice annual administration, so it could potentially be best in class. The Tezspire launch seems to be going really well. I saw Amgen, you know, you probably have better figures for this, Sam, but, you know, just what I could Google on Amgen's U.S. sales, look like the launch is going really well. So, you know, I think there are great prospects for a product that could potentially be a better, you know, a better mousetrap, if you will. I can't think of better hands though for a molecule like this to be in other than GSK. You know, this this asset is fairly early in development, and these are not easy trials. And you know, GSK certainly knows how to do these trials well. And since you know, there's a lot of challenging development ahead of it, you know, I'm sure that this is a really great home for this asset. So congratulations to the Aelios team and to our friend Bruce and Mike Gladstone over at Atlas for putting this together. But yeah, it looks like a flip, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure who else, what other investors were on there. I just, Atlas stood out to me, but congrats to all the investors and everyone who was involved. So Brad, did you want to talk about J&J and Ambrx?
Yeah, so this is a $2 billion deal, and surprise, surprise, it's an antibody drug conjugate company. I mean, talk about another theme, especially with like the Pfizer Seagen deal going through and Immunogen a couple of months back for big bucks. And this is a company that was formed out of the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla. In fact, it's literally across the street from Scripps. I visited Ambrx and did an interview there at the beginning of November. And they are, I think, at the right place at the right time with the right targets. So they really have two programs that are a focus. One's a HER2. So, you know, think of Enhertu and how, you know, successful that's been. And the other is a PSMA for prostate cancer. And, you know, think of the success that Novartis is having with on the radiopharmaceutical side. And then we've also seen, you know, other acquisitions of PSMA, PSMA programs. So this is another target that, you know, is really in vogue right now. And I remember interviewing, so the CEO right now, you know, just, I kind of view this as like a mini Immunogen story. You know, they've kind of bounced around and gone through the ups and downs of the ADC like field over, you know, recent years. And in fact, in 2015, it was bought out by like a consortium of Chinese investors, China Everbright, Fosun Pharma, WuXi Pharmatech, and others. And I interviewed Dan O'Connor, who's a really good guy, by the way. People might remember him from companies like Advaxis and OncoSec. And he's been running this company, I think, for about exactly a year. And the thing that I asked him when I interviewed him in November, I was like, you've got the right targets, you're at the right place at the right time, but like, you know, these are major companies like Astra and Daiichi on the Enhertu side and Novartis on the PSMA side. Like, how are you going to develop this and potentially compete with companies like that? And so I think it makes sense that they, you know, ended up deciding to sell at this point in time to a big company like J&J. So this, I would say, is not a surprising deal at all, because it's a modality that's totally in vogue. It's targets that are totally in vogue, and it's a small company that, you know, might have had a challenge developing it and ultimately competing with larger companies further on down the road.
Yep. For sure. And then, Sam, the one that we probably haven't been following as much, you know, on the device side of things, Boston Scientific acquiring Axonix, a urology company, for $3.7 billion. Did you follow this at all?
Well, I have to say I'm not a medical devices guy, as I'm sure anybody who knows me knows that. But not to let you down, we do have a medical devices analyst who I went to and got some very meaningful detail, I think. So one of the, I, you know, basically grilled him on a day off, so that was very kind of him. The Boston Scientific has been relatively aggressive in medtech M&A. I think you could just see that by going through, I don't know, whatever data source you use, Bloomberg, you can see that. And they have had success in the past decade, pretty much, looking for inorganic growth to just keep pushing on their organic business. So they go after some things that are not necessarily part of their current business areas. And this deal apparently follows the same trend. So our analyst thinks that Axonix could have revenue growth of around 25% in 24, which is quite significant. In this business area, if you think about it. And it adds a new technology, which is obviously urology, and the targets overactive bladder. So evaluation-wise, he thought that 7.7 times EV to revenue, it is clearly a premium to the usual sort of multiples that you see in medtech, but that might be supported by that 25% expectation if he's right. And it's not a very competitive area. The only other competitor really is Medtronic. And interestingly enough, Axonix and Medtronic do have an ongoing litigation going on. But that's the sort of thing that you regularly see in the medical devices business. So I don't think there's any particular worry on that. And the idea is that the Axonix product has a longer battery life, and the clinical data seems to show that they have better success rate at 2 years, 93% success rate. Those are the sorts of numbers that we get very excited by in the drug world. So I hope that was helpful. So, but it's pretty much outside my wheelhouse.
I think it's relevant because there are some of the same investors that invest in biotech benefit from this type of an acquisition. So actually, coming back to Josh's comments on froth, I thought it was really interesting to hear that a company called Metagenomi, which is backed by Moderna, is filing for an IPO. And this one was noteworthy for me as it's a preclinical company. And it's really one of the first preclinical IPOs we've heard of in a couple of years. The company got started in 2018, and they've raised about $400 million. So I guess the question is, you know, if we were to ask the investors, and I think RA and Peter Kolchinski was on here last week, he'd probably say that this is really another financing event rather than an exit. But to me, it was still surprising to see a preclinical IPO and almost like a sign that maybe the markets are turning. And I'd love to hear from everybody else here, Josh, Brad, and others.
Yeah, I can chime in on this one. the markets are much healthier, and personally, I've been a little surprised that the IPO window has been as tight as it's been, despite a very healthy secondary financing window and a sector that is starting to recover with some strong momentum. I think for the most part, investors have appreciated the more mature state of companies that have gone through the IPO process successfully to date. So Metagenomi will be a little different, but at least the comps and benchmarks in the gene edit space are pretty healthy. But I think as we progress throughout the year, we'll kind of go back to a much more traditional IPO environment where, you know, you have some earlier stage, some higher risk type companies going through, and those type of companies may be a little bit more dependent on their insiders and their existing shareholders to support them through the IPO process. But given how long the window has been closed, we're also going to see companies that have had more time to mature, to generate clinical data, and have a much stronger profile to bring to investors. And those companies are likely going to be far less reliant on their existing shareholders to support them through the process. So I'm pretty optimistic for the IPO landscape. And I think it is appropriate to have perhaps looser criteria than we've had in the, say, perhaps last year or so.
Yeah. I don't know, Brett, if you want to comment on that. And if you could also talk about some of the, there was a couple of setbacks this week. We had Astellas getting a CRL for its Claudin 18.2 drug. And then Vertex pausing diabetes cell therapy trial after two unrelated patient deaths.
Yeah. I'll start with Vertex. So, you know, this is been a very high profile program, even though it's been very early. So they're using stem cells to basically try to, cause to have insulin production. And it's only, they've only disclosed data on 14 patients. In fact, I think they've only done this to 14 patients. And so if you have two patient deaths, even if it's unrelated to the therapy, that's something you're going to want to look at very closely. So the announcement that they made, which was part of like a broader, just like general pipeline update, going into the conference, and it's not, as far as I can tell, an actual clinical hold yet right now from like the FDA. This is just like Vertex and like the review boards at the clinical trial sites, you know, taking a close look at this. But, you know, it does go to show that, like, everything in our industry is risk versus reward. Something we've all talked a lot about over the last month or so is what FDA has been saying about CAR-T. And, a lot of people have not been, like, super thrilled with that being in the news because, you know, the risk reward of, you know, very refractory late stage cancer patients compared to, you know, the responses that we're seeing with CAR-T, like, you know, really makes sense. Whereas like something like this for diabetics, it's, you know, a very serious thing, but at the same time, you know, there's treatments like insulins and things that you could use. So the biggest question is, as high profile as this been, as this has been, you know, there's other companies that are working on this same concept, and there's more startups that I've kind of heard through the grapevine about that may be getting into it. And so the big question is, will this, you know, really put the brakes on all of the development of this and slow it down and cause it to kind of fade away from the news, or, you know, will Vertex like figure this out and get it back up running and it won't have a wider effect? That's yet to be seen. And on the Astellas one, I actually kind of missed this news, but, you know, Claudin 18.2, we've talked a lot about that. You know, claudins are proteins that are found in like folding sections of tissues, and it has huge utility in things like gastric cancer and pancreatic cancer and things like that. And in my predictions for 2023, I said that 2023 was, from a business development standpoint, going to be like Claudin 18.2 Palooza, and it really was. So to see a program, like this get a CRL is again like something that you have to wonder if it has like a class effect or not. So we'll have to watch, but I have to admit, I didn't see like the specifics of why I got the CRL, so can't comment further on it.
So that's an excellent point, Brad, because I worried about it when I saw it because of all the other 18.2s or 6s with regards to Astra, BioNTech. But it's a CMC issue by the sound of it, third-party manufacturing facility problem. So
okay.
That's what this is what the press release said. So
yeah, well, in that case, like, I mean, the significance of it, you know, Astellas was always out in front. They were kind of one of, you know, the first company to get it in front of FDA. And with such a huge, it's very similar to like the BCMA field, is that like, you know, 1 year at ASH, you had literally like, it seemed like over 50 BCMA products. And what you've ultimately seen is there's been very few like first to market winners. You know, you have like Carvykti and to a lesser extent, the Bristol program. And then you have a couple of the BCMA or the bispecifics that have made it to the market. And then the other like 56 programs that were at ASH that year, like ultimately didn't make it. And so Astellas is in a position like being the leader, it's really important for them to like, you know, to protect their leadership position, get on the market, and really, you know, put the onus on all of those other dozens and dozens and dozens of Claudin 18.2 competitors to figure out a way to like get on the market and compete with them. So any slowdown, in this case, if it's CMC, like that's a, you know, that's really unfortunate for Astellas, and it might open the window for, you know, some of those other companies to get on the market a lot sooner compared to Astellas than they thought.
Actually, Daphne, talking about CMC manufacturing, one of the interesting things that I hope I'm not digressing too far from the point here, but I'm burning to talk about it. So is if you listen to what Lilly and Novartis said at the meeting, because everybody, the world and their uncle wants, except for J&J, of course, is into obesity in one way or another now, right? Everyone's licensing, buying, whatever. So what we've got a situation that's quite interesting is that it was very clear that I hadn't quite thought about this, is that you got two very advanced companies with true manufacturing requirements. So they can put genuine cash down, calculate their expected next year, the year after, the year after, the year after flow, and go and book volume in wherever they can get to. Either they own it or they get it from a third party. Talking about that. So how can anyone else with an earlier stage injectable, not oral, come and actually have any hope of getting meaningful manufacturing capacity unless they have it themselves to compete with the in size? That's something that I hadn't quite thought about. We thought about everything else, second to market, third to market, fourth to market, efficacy, side effect profile, dosing. But what about actually making it? These guys are finding it hard to make. They've got the product. They can commit to whatever capacity you've got for me, I'll take it. And that suddenly made me realize that perhaps is an angle that we hadn't thought about when it comes to competition.
There are some companies looking to make similar products that are much more scalable. So it'll be interesting to see how that.
On the oral or injectables?
Potentially both.
Well, oral I can see. Oral is out of this equation, right? Because you don't need the sterile finish and any of that. I'd love to hear the rest of that, Josh.
Still early, but I know they're just trying to work on formulations that are much easier to scale.
Yeah, and Don, you had mentioned something interesting about the Novo CEO commenting on the risks of safety issues with small molecule GLP-1 agonists.
Well, I think he makes a really great point, right? Is the potential off-target toxicities with small molecules versus, you know, an endogenous peptide, which is a super clean type of approach, which, you know, is not devoid of safety issues as we've seen. But it's going to take a lot for a small molecule to overcome the huge database that the peptides, the injectables will have and will continue to, you know, to increase. You know, especially considering how large potential patient populations there are to treat. So it's going to be very interesting to watch this space and see how regulatory agencies are going to respond to orals, either against this, you know, well-known and understood target or other novel targets coming, you know, that will be emerging in the obesity space.
Josh, you wanted to comment on Gotham?
Yeah, so there is an interesting update this week. Gotham City Research launched a short attack against Grifols, which is a Spanish-based plasma-derived therapeutics company, basically accusing them of accounting irregularities. What happened was that Grifols bought a couple of businesses and then immediately turned around and sold those businesses to kind of a partner company called Scranton SA that's partly owned by the Grifols family, but not by Grifols shareholders. And they retained full control of these entities. They had an option to purchase these entities. And because of that, they wound up consolidating the earnings of these entities into their financial reports. And Gotham kind of makes the case that that's not appropriate, that these companies that did seem to account for a meaningful amount of Grifols' earnings should in fact not have been consolidated by Grifols and kind of left as Scranton earnings. And so Grifols kind of defended its accounting and business practice on the call. It wasn't exactly clear to me what the rationale was for buying assets, selling assets, and consolidating assets. Seemed like a somewhat odd business move, and it might have been related to their limited debt capacity, but still not perfectly clear why they would have undertaken that type of transaction. Grifols stock's down like 30% this week. The company has indicated that they plan to sue Gotham City Research for financial and reputational damage, but kind of an interesting reminder of things that can get lost in very long SEC or other financial filings that some investors from time to time will dig up to make life interesting. I don't know if anyone else was following that precedent, but it's another reason to have at least some fluency with accounting.
Has this ever happened where the company, the short sellers and written and stories, oh, that's happened. But has a company ever managed to successfully sue a short seller research house like that?
Oh, not that I've ever seen. No. They do sue them, but successfully, I've not seen that.
The best way to punish them is to do well and like a short squeeze. But I was trying to, as you're talking, I'm trying to see who their auditors are. It's not apparent on the website, but I'm surprised. Usually those kinds of things are picked up by, if you have a decent auditor, they will say like, don't, they won't allow a company to do things that are borderline like that.
Definitely, they're not the most open company. If you go and on the terminal, for instance, the Bloom terminal, and look for transcripts of their calls, you won't find many. It's not like you can have, they do a site visit every now and then. They're very restrictive of who can go. But it's a family-run business, right? I'm not criticizing them. I'm just telling you that. So it was probably a relatively easy target. And, the short sellers, and again, I'm not blaming them for what they did. Short sellers, I guess, pick their targets, right?
Yeah, I hadn't been following. It's really fascinating to take a look at it. Thanks for flagging it, Josh. So we have another 10 minutes. I'm not sure if anybody else has other thoughts they wanted to cover. I mean, I thought I was interested in the sauna thing, but I haven't really been following it closely. But go ahead, Brad.
Yeah, I want to share a thought that popped into my head about cytokinetics. And what made me think of this is one of the most fascinating and popular videos that I recorded this week was with Biohaven. And I think it's really the history of Biohaven is super fascinating. So, they sold Nurtec, the migraine drug, to Pfizer for many, many billions. I think it was like 11.6 billion or something close to that. But they sold only that drug, actually that class, like that class. And then they had this whole pipeline behind it, and everybody, like the leadership of Biohaven, stayed on and spun that out into a new company. And now that new company is worth like over $4 billion. And they have a lot of super interesting things that they're working on. And I'm wondering if that's going to be a trend in our industry going forward. Like, rather than seeing like straight up buyouts of companies, if you'll start to see biotech companies that have expertise in something succeeding in selling a drug and, you know, keep going with like a pipeline. And it made me think of Cytokinetics. So I've interviewed Cytokinetics twice. So once at Thanksgiving before their data, and then on the day of their data, I did like a virtual interview with Robert Blum as well. And I've asked him about acquisitions, and he just gives like the standard answer. Like, if people talk to us, we have a shareholder responsibility to, you know, to think about it or whatever. So I don't have any knowledge or anything. I'm just sharing like a thought that's in my head. But like, Cytokinetics is super interesting because, like, you've probably heard this in the news. They've been around now for almost like three decades, and they have a very unique expertise, which is muscle biology. And their expertise is so unique. With their head of R&D, I filmed this video that I thought was really cool, where he showed like 10 years ago, they had to invent their own equipment to actually like test drugs in the lab. Like, the equipment itself for like this corner of drug development didn't even exist. So they invented equipment that helped them understand like what effect their medicines were having on the muscle. And so, you know, I'm just thinking, like, for a company that's been around for 30 years, that's built up like literally three decades of experience, like in this particular type of science, it'd be really unfortunate for medicine if this gets acquired by some big pharma company only for this drug, and they dismantle the rest of Cytokinetics, which, you know, let's face it, like, happens in our industry a lot. And so I was just thinking, like, the light bulb went off in my head after interviewing Biohaven, like, this would be a great case for something like that to happen too. Like, maybe they can sell the drug and continue to like leverage this decades of experience they've built up in this type of science and develop more medicines for, you know, for other muscle disorders. And so I'm wondering, with Biohaven becoming a success so quickly, like a $4 billion company after that, if this is something that's on the minds of more people and will ultimately like end up being a trend in our industry, I wouldn't be surprised if it does.
Yeah, I think that it makes a lot of sense. So if you're in a management team that's talking to a potential acquirer and you're not getting full credit, you know, for some piece of the business that you could potentially, you know, spin out separately or whatever, that makes total sense to do that. I thought that Biohaven deal was really smart, and I agree with you. I think it does make sense.
Yeah, and Daphne, to shoot some credit your way, of course. I mean, we talked about this in our video about PureTech. In many ways, that's what you do with your founded entities too. Like, you know, think of Karuna, build something, have it succeed, you know, benefit from that success, and, you know, develop other things that are successes, and keep the innovation, you know, cycle going and, you know, continuing on. So you're right in the middle of this whole idea in a big and successful way as well.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. Yeah,
Daphne, correct me if I'm wrong though, but you designed PureTech kind of to do just that, right? Like to almost on a, like, a project by project basis, whereas I see the Cytokinetics being very different, with this kind of very deep expertise in muscle diseases that, and like an asset that's way ahead of the rest of their pipeline. And, you know, how do you really capitalize on that? If you sell off aficamten and then you, you know, now you've got like earlier assets, you know, your most of your value is going to go out the door with aficamten. And then you have to somewhat like re-up your financing to really capitalize on the deep expertise you have in muscle diseases to bring forward other candidates. But I agree with you, Brad. I don't think companies like that get enough credit for what they've built. And, you know, the best maybe that they could hope to do, and the way things currently are, is find a great home where people are certainly interested in muscle diseases and taking that early pipeline and committing to, you know, to continue resourcing that and investing in that.
Yeah. No, I think there's more openness to different models, different structures. You know, it just makes sense, right? If you have trapped value, to figure out how to unlock that value. So, you know, I definitely liked it when I saw the Biohaven deal, and, you know, obviously companies like Roivant and BridgeBio and others, you know, also doing things that are similar. But I agree with you 100% on that, Don and Brad. So we're getting close to the end of time. I just want to mention that one of the things that really stood out to me this week was almost every meeting I had, even like networking events, people mentioned that they listened to Biotech Hangout. And that was, I think, a very big difference from last year, but it was really nice. And it was nice to meet a lot of the folks that listen and get that feedback and appreciate the fact that there's so many folks in the industry that are enjoying and benefiting from the discussion that we're having. So, you know, please continue to give us feedback and any you know, feedback on things that we could also do better. So, you know, really appreciated seeing everyone this week, and Brad in particular. It was fun to hang out with you. So I will ask you guys just to make some closing remarks before we sign off.
I'll just say that, I mean, you said it in your introduction, Daphne, but like the mood was great. And I mean, it's not a surprise. Like Bruce tweeted out layering data that the 2 month period of November and December were the best 2 months in biotech history. Obviously, it's from a low, but it was like a 14% gain in November and an 18% gain in December. And then when you think of all of the deals that have been happening, not just this last week, but like the last, you know, couple of months, it just, you know, it's like a breath of fresh air and that can, you know, has uplifted like our entire sector. And so I think that it's nice for a change to start the year like in a good mood. And I think that people are really like cautiously optimistic that we could have a pretty good year for our sector ahead. So hopefully it'll keep staying in the right direction.
Yeah, and Biotech TV is on fire, by the way. Like so many people mentioned it, and it was really just very helpful to get all those videos and be able to learn about all the different companies and the news.
So, thanks. Yeah. I'll tease something. So I'm proud to say I signed two new sponsors this last week, and I've got something really cool cooking over the coming weeks that I can't wait to show everyone that will really take it to an even higher level.
Super exciting.
Well, yeah, Brad, you sound suitably exhausted. So 20 interviews, etc. It's different sitting in front of a management team and listening to them. And I wasn't even there. So hopefully next year I can join you and at least sharing a drink. I do share the enthusiasm for this year. It's been 3 years that I hadn't. I thought we were going to go through a tech bubble 2020 situation, and that sort of transpired to be the case. 50-50 chance of getting it right. So, but now I think we're on relatively good footing. I do know one macro strategist who's talking about interest rates going down to zero this year. So maybe if that happens, we're going to be off to the moon with the biotech sector.
Yeah, just have the election has to go.
Oh yeah, sorry, I forgot about that.
Well, we have an election here in the U.S., but no, hopefully, fingers crossed that the interest rates help a lot. Don,
yeah, Daphne, I'm always optimistic because I've always said like think to be a drug developer you have to be pathologically optimistic, but perhaps even more optimistic than usual for this year. I love seeing the deal making. You know, I really am reflecting on Peter Kulczynski's comments in the Biotech Hangout last week about not being a bystander. And so I want to think more about in 2024, you know, how I can, you know, contribute to educating, you know, policymakers and maybe even the general public about why it's so important to keep this industry vibrant. I mean, I think we've made a lot of good points. This industry will figure out a way, no matter, you know, what the public policy headwinds are, to continue to be innovative. But it's such a vitally important sector for our country and the world that, I want to do my part to contribute to that. And I know we all do. So really appreciate Peter's comments from last week as well.
Yeah, well said. So I know everybody is like, just the adrenaline is just wearing off, and some of us are getting colds. It sounds like you're getting one, Brad, from the plane travel and all the networking. But it was a great week, and I wish you all a great weekend. Just relax a little bit, and we'll see you all next week on Biotech Hangout. Thank you.